Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's a G-Zero world, says my next guest, Ian Bremmer, not G8, not G20. No one nation or group of nations has the power to bring about solutions to global crises, and that includes the challenge of climate change. So joining me now to talk about the global leadership vacuum that he sees and what it means for climate change is Ian Bremmer, president of the Eurasia Group, a global political risk research and consulting firm. He's now the author of the book, Every Nation for Itself, Winners and Losers in a G-Zero World. Ian, welcome back.
Brian, good morning to you.
And before we even get to climate change, you were just telling me that you see the Chen standoff in China right now as a representative issue for a G-Zero world.
I do. I see a lot of U.S.-China issues as representative of a G-Zero world. I remember when Xi Jinping was about to come and meet with President Obama the week before they decided to veto the Security Council resolution on Syria. Now we have Secretary of State Hillary Clinton in Beijing on the eve of the strategic and economic dialogue and thinks she has a deal with the Chinese in allowing protection for a noted dissident that was at the U.S. embassy. No sooner did they let him go than the Chinese clearly reneged on the agreements they'd made with the United States. How embarrassing for an Obama administration in an election period. The Chinese don't care. And no one else is going to say boo. This is emblematic of the kind of issues we see in a G-Zero world.
But were we a few years ago in what you might have called a G-1 world with one superpower, the United States, and China wouldn't have dared do such a thing? I'm not sure that's true.
I think that we have, in the post-war era, been enjoying different manifestations of a G1. You could call it a G5, a G6, a G7, a G8. But the reality was that post-World War II, it was American capital, American priorities, American allies, American institutions that really did define the way the world economy worked and a lot of the way that world security worked too. And all of that is no longer functional post the 2008 financial crisis.
But did that get enhanced after the Cold War? Because a lot of people would say, well, the Cold War was a two-superpower world, even though it was after World War II.
Well, I would argue that the G1 only became – it was already in existence on the economic side. When the Soviet Union collapsed in 1991, suddenly the World Bank, the IMF, the Bretton Woods Agreement, I mean all the WTO, all of these institutions that really were the way the global economy functioned – absent a sclerotic Soviet economy and a few of its allies, suddenly you had 15 new countries to invest in the former Soviet space. So it sped up that G1 process, even though there was a bipolar world on the security and nuclear front.
So you write in the book that climate change is Exhibit A when it comes to the inability of established and emerging powers to agree on anything. Why climate change as Exhibit A?
Well, because you know we saw it at Copenhagen, right? There was at that point there was such an extraordinary belief that here is a problem. It is clearly pressing. The science has, you know, it could not be more stark.
The big climate change conference in 2009.
Absolutely. And we've had issues like this before when we thought there was a hole in the ozone and it was going to sort of rip apart, the safety and the health of people. And we had a Montreal Protocol. The world got together. It resolved it. So finally, after decades of research, we understand that carbon in the atmosphere is causing global warming. The scientists are overwhelmingly agreed on that. And what better issue for the world to come together and do something on? And of course, it ended in complete disarray. And since then, we've had a series of summits in Cancun, in Durban. And the only way you can claim that they're successful is that we have reduced our expectations so startlingly that you only have to step over the bar. You don't have to jump it.
And you write colorfully about the chaos at that Copenhagen summit, as in the French president accused the Chinese of hypocrisy. The Norwegian leader accused the Indian officials of reneging on their proposal. Hugo Chavez of Venezuela called President Obama the devil.
The devil.
There was the G-Zero world in all its glory.
It is. And it's not because the United States is the devil. It's not because the Chinese are so short-sighted. It's because you have a bunch of countries sitting around a table that have absolutely completely different value systems. This is not the U.S. and like-minded developed states. If you want an agreement on climate, you must get the big emitters from the emerging market world out there. They are poor countries. And as poor countries with per capita income that are radically lower than those of the United States or Japan or Germany, they just don't value improving the environment the way they would value ensuring a baseline of economic growth and unemployment. We've got real unemployment in the United States is 15% right now. And yet we are suitably rich as a country that we still value the environment. We still want to improve miles per gallon, maybe not as much as we should, but it matters to us. That is a luxury that we will not see in this world when the largest economy becomes China. And that is coming. China will become the world's largest economy in 5 and 10 or 20 years, but it will still be a fundamentally poor country. And we underappreciate just how radically different the world will be in that environment.
So is this paralysis anybody's fault? I mean, when the Kyoto Protocol was in effect, the previous global warming agreement, and the U.S. wasn't a party to it, everybody blamed the United States for being too conservative or too selfish.
Yes, it's all Obama's fault, of course. No, I mean, people do say that, of course. They blame Obama. They blame Romney. There's this big debate now, is the U.S. in decline or not? And people say it's in decline because Obama's leading from behind. Let's just say, whether or not you believe the U.S. is in decline, do you think that there's anyone that's remotely electable in the United States that would put together a Marshall Plan to help bail out the Europeans? Would anyone lead a global climate deal? Would anyone remove Assad from power in Syria? Everyone's talking about Iran right now. I'm getting questions about Israel bombing Iran because people don't think it's credible, rightly in my view, that the Americans are going to do it. This is not an issue of Obama versus Romney. This is, for the last 30 years, structurally, the world has moved. Global power has shifted from the U.S. toward China, from developed states towards emerging markets. But the global architecture hasn't changed at all. And at some point, 2008, you had a crisis that was big enough that just cracked that disparity of power. And is that anybody's fault? It's the fault of the world system, but we're all going to have to live through it.
Ian Bremmer from the consulting firm The Eurasia Group, author now of Every Nation for Itself, Winners and Losers in a G-Zero World. So nobody is driving the bus, as you write, but several states have their foot on the brakes or they're lying in the middle of the road. I'm not sure what the right phrase would be in this case, but what's the difference between having the power to create a solution to the climate change problem and the power to block a solution? Because, as you tell it, enough countries have that much power.
Well, it's the difference between removing Gaddafi in Libya and a civil war in Syria that is now actually expanding over its borders into Lebanon and into Turkey. In Libya, Gaddafi was hated by absolutely everyone in the entire region, the Iranians and the Saudis, which is actually hard to pull off. There's nobody else like that in the Middle East. The Syrians have a couple friends, and they can stop anyone from acting because no one's going to pull the trigger by themselves. And so what's happened? Assad is still there. The military is still there. They're still killing civilians today. And the civil war is metastasizing. In fact, if you look across the Middle East, the only country that I could focus on that has a definably positive trajectory, despite the Arab Spring, is Tunisia, which is great for Tunisia, but it's not exactly the country we spend most of our time talking about. This is a direct reaction to the G-Zero.
And so back to the U.S. and China and climate change for that matter. The U.S. and China together account for, I think it's about 40% of global greenhouse emissions. So if these two big powers could agree on something, they would be the leaders necessary to make headway on climate change?
It would certainly make a big difference. I mean, the way I think about what happened, how do you get out of the G0 environment? What comes next? And one of the two big questions you have to ask is the one that you just implicitly did, which is, what's the relationship between the U.S. and China? Is it relatively harmonious? If it is, and it is not now, and the trajectory is clearly negative, and anyone that's watching Hillary Clinton should understand that. But if it were to become...
You mean act uncomfortably in Beijing this week?
Yeah, absolutely. But it's also about security relations in the East and South China Sea. It's about Syria and Iran. It's about indigenous innovation and problems of U.S. corporations with market access. It's cybersecurity. I mean, the list is as long as my arm in challenges. China's like the Voldemort of U.S. enemies. They're the geopolitical foe whose name must not be spoken, but everyone knows that that's where the problems are. If that doesn't get fixed, it's virtually impossible to imagine an environment where you're going to be able to deal with issues like climate.
But nature abhors a vacuum, and so does geopolitics. So who is rising in this leaderless G0, as you call it, world?
Well, so if I'd make a bet, because I agree that we're not going to see the G0 for a generation, right? Something will replace it. I'd bet U.S.-China gets worse, but I bet that other countries actually start mattering more. I think Europe does get through this crisis, not as effectively or as cleanly as we'd like, but governance in Europe is going to be better post-crisis than it was pre-crisis. They'll be an important player on the global stage. So will Brazil. So certainly will India over time, and a host of other countries. And what that means is that we'll be moving towards a world where we won't have global institutions or architecture. We won't have global leadership. It'll be much more regional. And those regions will differ radically. This is not globalization's writ small. This is Europe is politics and economics that's driving integration. Eurasia is more coercive. It's more security and energy. In Asia, economics drives you towards China, but security drives you to the United States. Mm. And in the Middle East, critically speaking, you actually have sectarianism driving that part of the world apart because the Saudis, the Iranians, the Turks have completely different models that they want to see in place.
And the subtitle of the book is Winners and Losers in a G0 World. Let's go through a few of these before you go. You lump Brazil and Turkey together, very different countries in very different parts of the world, and call them pivot states.
I do, and I call them pivot states because in a G0 world, you don't line up with U.S.-led globalization. If you have a world where different regions have different modes of integrating and creating winners and losers, you want to be able to make multiple bets. You want to play the field. And Brazil and Turkey play the field very well. Turkey can work and develop good relations with the Caspian and build energy infrastructure with Russia, and they do a lot of consumer goods that they send there, and they do a lot of construction. No one has a better relationship and taking better advantage of the growth in Iraq than the Turks are, and they still have this candidate membership with Europe. So there's a lot the Turks can do. The Brazilians, too. The Americans have a very strong relationship, but China is now their lead trading partner. Mm. And that's very attractive for countries like those, but also a country like Canada, a developed state, which, yes, we can build an XL Keystone pipeline up to take advantage of the oil sands, but I know 1.3 billion Chinese that would like to do the exact same thing.
And you refer to Africa as a pivot continent. How so? It's an entire continent, for one thing, not a country. And we were just talking about how the poorest nations in Africa are so vulnerable to climate change because the big powers can't get it together.
Oh, there's no question that climate's going to hurt them a great deal. But if you think about the impact of the G0 directly on them, you've got dozens of countries that are now, they're urbanizing. Africa as a whole, 50% urbanization. That's higher than India. And that means you're going to get education, especially of women. The demographics become more normalized. They're starting to consume. So it's not just about commodities anymore. And as Africa becomes sort of the last untapped market, everyone wants to come in, and it allows Africa not just to get captured by China and to have to make whatever deal the Chinese want to come in to support some dictator. It allows them to actually get better management, more infrastructure, support local labor, all of those things which Africa desperately needs. We've been saying Africa's going to come for a long time now. I think Africa's decade is almost upon us. It's maybe 2015 2025.
Certainly would be their turn. And on the loser side, you have NATO, the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, what you call referees, partly because Chinese banks and other emerging market lenders are competing successfully with the IMF and World Bank. You also include Human Rights Watch as a loser and Doctors Without Borders. Doctors Without Borders?
See, all of these are U.S. or European-led global institutions. And going forward, we won't have U.S. or European-led global institutions. We'll either have U.S.-led institutions that aren't global, or we'll have global institutions that aren't U.S.-led. Hmm. And we'll have to decide which of those we want. On trade, we've given up on Doha, and we're doing what we call the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the TPP, which is basically saying we're going to have a like-minded, smaller group of countries, Mexico, Canada, Japan, South Korea, Australia, and we're going to do it with them. But you know what? China, Russia, no, not unless you behave the way we want you to. And so we're going to have a smaller but deeper group to create integration. But we haven't done that in things like the World Bank or the IMF. And until we do, those organizations will get weaker.
And just before you go, companies. We've been talking about countries or continents as winners and losers, or these NGOs like Doctors Without Borders and the World Bank. But you list, for example, ExxonMobil as a winner because they can offer partnerships and benefits that government can't. We just had Steve Call yesterday on his new book about ExxonMobil as, you know, an empire impervious to government power.
I wouldn't say they're impervious, but a lot of the smaller countries out there, ExxonMobil has an awful lot of leverage. There's no question. Talk to ExxonMobil about China. We'll see how impervious they think they actually are. But no one's been able to cut a better deal in Russia than ExxonMobil because they're so big, they're so important, they have the technology and management that they can really help the Kremlin exploit the Arctic. That puts them in a strong position. But companies as a whole also need to be able to adapt. You don't want to be a small company that can only make one or two emerging market bets. The G0 is a world that is much more risky, and therefore you don't look just for growth. You have to look for resilience too. That means if you're small, the developed world is actually safer for you. If you're big, you've got to take lots of bets. You don't do what Yum Brands is doing and say KFC is just about China, because then you're in trouble. You do what Coca-Cola is doing. They're in 208 countries. They do 1.8 billion transactions every day. They're much more effectively hedged.
So is this what you tell your clients? Because your real job when you're not writing books is consulting companies on political risk around the world.
Well, I like the fact that part of my real job is talking to you, Brian. So let's be clear. But sure, of course we talk to companies about all of this stuff because the companies do understand that this is a radically different environment. But companies are also very short term. And so even though the environment has changed, they still are prepared to say, wow, there are these huge returns I can get for my shareholders and my own compensation next quarter if I just bet the ranch on the next group of emerging markets. In this environment, that's actually a very dangerous thing to do.
Ian Bremmer, president of the Eurasia Group, a global political risk research and consulting firm. His new book is called Every Nation for Itself, Winners and Losers in a G0 World. Fascinating stuff, Ian. Thank you very much.
Brian, always a pleasure to be with you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And up next, the developmental case for sending your child to sleepaway camp. Stay with us.